Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We have been, for the last several months, talking about leading the Christian life, how to live knowing who you are, that you are the redeemed, you are the elect, you are the beloved, you are the body of Christ, you are the bride of Christ, you are the church of the redeemed, you are the people whose names have been written down in the Lamb's Book of Life since before the foundation of the world. That is the way that the Bible describes believers. And then Paul uses all that identification as the basis to say, knowing that's who you are, now live like this. And so we have, for the last couple of months, been emphasizing live like this. And I love that balance. As I've said many, many times, both sides of the equation are part of the gospel. The gospel is you're saved by grace through faith, and the gospel is equally now live like it. You've been bought with a price, that's absolutely true. But now you are owned by a master, and he has every right to lay his responsibility and expectations on you. Hold on, we have a parade coming through the back door. Hold on. I'm going to wait one more second because Melissa has the baby with her, and so there will be baby passing time happening here among the women. No, you okay? All right. You'll stay back there. Okay. Yeah, but as soon as I said you had the baby with you, Pam's eyes lit up. Yeah, the hormones, you could feel it. You could just feel the maternal instinct kicked in. Pam was like, baby, where? I'm like, go to the baby. I don't.
Okay, cast it up.
Give up the baby and nobody gets hurt. That's all she's saying. All right. Both sides of the equation are equally true. That's where I left off. I know where I was. Both sides of the equation are true. We are saved by grace through faith. Salvation is God's enterprise of glorifying himself. Far too often, Arminian-type theology that talks about salvation leaves the impression that human beings are the crown of God's creation. We're the absolute pinnacle of creation, and therefore God is saving humans because humans are just so intrinsically good and wonderful and valuable that it just wouldn't be heaven without some humans there. And therefore God is practically obligated to go get some people because those people are just so good and bring them up to heaven. But you don't find that language anywhere in the Bible. Salvation of human beings is always a matter of God by grace and mercy drawing sinners to himself. Men who start out dead in their trespasses and sins, and God in his grace and kindness saves them anyway, despite themselves. God draws them to himself so that he can demonstrate how gracious and merciful and loving he is. So salvation is always a matter of God glorifying himself. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And he does it through saving people like us. Is there anybody in the room who would like to argue that you are so intrinsically good that God simply should save you based on your multiple good works and genuine moral stability? Anyone want to argue for that? I didn't think so. If you had, we'd have had to escort you out. No, the reality is it's always God saving people for his own reasons. But once he has saved somebody, he has every right to expect you to live like people that he has indeed saved. So we've been emphasizing the second half of that equation for the last few months. And when we get to the end of the letter of Colossians, we're going to then move to the next of Paul's prison epistles, the book of Ephesians, which probably is being carried by the same Tychicus that I mentioned last week, Tychicus is taking this letter back to Colossae, and he's probably carrying the letter to the Ephesians with him as well. And then he's also got this slave, Onesimus, with him, and he's traveling from Rome back into Asia, carrying letters from Paul and information from Paul. And so it makes sense that we would read the Ephesian letter after we read the Colossians letter. But in order to do that, we're going to swing the pendulum back the other way and go from your responsibility as a Christian back to what God does when he saves people. And the first three chapters of the book of Ephesians is going to get into all that heavy-duty language of God's predestinary will and God's foreknowledge and God's absolute sovereignty in the salvation of human beings. All that theology that makes people uncomfortable because it takes away every vestige of your ego, your will, your value, and instead it says Christ is indeed all. He is everything. He is all and in all, and therefore he is saving you for his own glory. It's a great God-glorifying theology. It's simply not the popular theology of salvation. It's the true theology of salvation. It's the biblical theology of salvation. It's just not the popular one. So starting this morning, we're going to start swinging that pendulum back into the theology of salvation. Because Paul, in writing to Ephesus, we'll say more about this in our introductory comments to the letter when we get to it, but Paul is writing to the capital of proconsul Asia at that moment. This is a portion of the Roman Empire. And the capital of that area is this city of Ephesus that sits right on the edge of the Aegean Sea. And so there's a great deal of commerce going on there, a lot of traffic going on there. So Paul is very purposeful in making sure that he sends a letter to Ephesus knowing that it's going to circulate from there out. In the beginning of the book of Revelation, the seven churches of Asia that are mentioned, you can go back and trace them historically where there was a road that circulated from Ephesus through each of those cities and wound up back at Ephesus. So Ephesus is very much a hub of philosophy and information and religion. And in fact, one of the ancient seven wonders of the world is at Ephesus, the temple to Diana. So there's a lot of pagan religion going on there. And so because Paul never specifically says in his letter to the Ephesians, because he never particularly says the word Ephesus, you know, this letter is to the church at Ephesus in particular, a lot of historians think that maybe this was sort of an encyclical that he wrote that he expected to circulate to all the churches there in Asia. The reason that's important is because you're talking about Paul creating the fundamental theology that is going to be the bedrock thinking of the Christian church. This is the letter that he's going to want to have circulate widely through the Christian church. And so the theology that he launches right into at the beginning of that letter is very, very important. Because everybody who picks up this letter, which is clearly identified as being from Paul in Rome, there's no historic argument about who wrote it. And so we know that this is the theology of the first century church, and he's going to launch right into God's sovereignty and salvation and predestination and God's foreknowledge and all of that theology. So we have to get our thinking correct when we think about the theology of salvation when Paul was making sure that the Christian church was founded on sound doctrine. What did he think about salvation? And in this letter that circulated throughout the first century church, he started right in with, it's all God, 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 God. God does it all. It's all grace, 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 grace. And nowhere are you going to see him say, but you got to kick in your 2%. You got to do your 5. You got to do your good work. None of that. And then just like with the Colossian letter, after he's done identifying who we are and how we've been saved and the glory and sovereignty of God, he's going to turn around and say, now live like it. And we're going to swing the pendulum back the other way and talk about what it is to live like a Christian. So those are the coming attractions. That's where we're headed here. So first we have to close up the book of Colossians, and then we can work our way over into the book of Ephesians, and it promises to be a lot of fun. Colossians 4, the first two verses we read last week as we were reading from Philemon, I don't agree with the chapter division right there. The first verse should have been the end of chapter 3, because it is the counterbalance of what Paul said to slaves in obeying their masters. Then he turns his attention to masters. Grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven. I would have added that to the end of the previous chapter. I think that verse 2 now is a brand new thought. Because then verse 2 starts with what I believe is a universal admonition to the church. Devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. It's a very interesting translation that the New American Standard went with there. Because there are two key words there that I think are just brilliant. Because Paul knows what we're like. Here, I'll show you. Anybody here in this room have no problem praying whenever you want and devoting yourself to it? Can you just pray endlessly with no problems? Anybody got that great gift of nobody? Nobody? Anybody in this room struggle to pray? Isn't that something? We're the Christian people. We're the bought before the foundation of the world. We're the saints of God. And so Paul has to say, knowing what we're like, knowing our humanity, knowing our frailty, he has to say, not just pray, but devote yourself to prayer. I have found in my own life, in my own experience, and you'll probably all relate, that I can get so busy and so caught up in all the stuff that I have to do in life that I'll forget to pray. I can go a couple of days, and by the time I hit the bed, usually I try at the end of every day to just kind of stop, think through my day, think of the blessings of the day, think of the hardships of the day that God got me through, try not to take that day for granted, and then stop and pray and thank Him for that day. And I try to do it. I mean to do it. It's my intention to do it. I just don't always do it. Because some days, I'm just dead. I'm done. By the time I get to bed, all I can think is pillow, and I'm done. And I forget to pray. Anybody here skipped days when you should have prayed and you just didn't? Yeah, it's pretty much all of us, isn't it? Because it's so easy to get wrapped up in our flesh. I think the reason, one of the many reasons, that the Bible puts so much emphasis on prayer is that we need to stop regularly and recognize that all the stuff, all the fleshly stuff, all the cars and clothes and things and work and trouble and money and TV and games and things, all that is the fluff of life. All of that is passing. All of that ends up in a junkyard somewhere eventually anyway. All the stuff, the tangible stuff of life. We need to stop regularly, make ourselves do it, devote ourselves to stopping and recognizing that this world is not our home. This is not our permanent residence. We need to stop and talk to our Father in heaven. We need to reconnect to the fact that we're spiritual people, that we're Christian people. I've told this story before. I had a friend several years ago who was going in to have surgery. And she was concerned about her surgery, and she said to me one day, "Do you believe in the power of prayer?" And she, knowing that I was a Christian person and a Bible teacher, she was certain what my answer was going to be. She said, "Do you believe in the power of prayer?" And I surprised her and I said, "No, I don't." And she was sort of taken aback. And I said, "But I do believe in the power of the God I pray to. So I'll pray to Him and maybe He'll help you." So then what is the point of prayer? Let's talk about prayer for a second and what the point is. I don't believe that you can change God's mind through constantly going to Him and insisting on having your way. So then does prayer actually change anything? What's the point of prayer? What's the point of going to Him with your requests? What's the point of going to God and talking about the things you want and the things you need and your heart and your struggles and your children? What's the point if it's not going to change God's mind? And my argument has always been, prayer does change things. It changes us. It changes us and brings us into conformity to the mind and the will of God. Have you ever noticed that you can be at your absolute wit's end about something? You can be right at the edge of just not knowing what you're going to do about something, and just stopping and talking to God about it can bring you a peace about it that you didn't have before you prayed. Because that is the process of bringing yourself before the throne of God and recognizing that His sovereignty does in fact overrule your desire and your will and your wants. And once you know that, there's comfort in it. There's great comfort in knowing that whatever comes into your life, it can't reach you unless your sovereign Father who loves you says it's okay for it to come reach you. I love when Paul was writing to the Corinthians and he said, there is no temptation taken you, no trial, no trouble in this life. There's no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. In other words, you're not the first to go through it. Other people have gone through this. This is the common human experience. Pain, that's part of the experience. Heartache, struggle, part of the experience. Now, if Paul had just left it there, it would have seemed kind of callous. If Paul had just said, yeah, whatever you're going through, that's just life. Buck up. Not that Paul ever would have written the words, buck up. But just, you know, get used to it, live with it. That would have been callous. But instead he said, there is no temptation taken you but such as common to man. The next words are key, but God is faithful. Isn't that great to know? That whatever your struggle is, whatever your trial is, didn't change the faithfulness of God. God is still on His throne doing whatever seems good to Him. Whatever pleases Him, that's what He does. And it pleased Him to take you through this trial. So therefore, this trial must somehow be for your good. And when you know that the trials and the troubles have purpose, it makes it easier. Because the end of that verse then says, but God is faithful, who will not tempt you beyond that, that you're able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Isn't that interesting psychology? Because what he's saying is, if you know that God is faithful and that He knows you're in the midst of this struggle, and if He has provided a way of escaping that trial, you'll get through the trial because you know it's not forever and God is faithful and I will get through this. If you know you're going to get through it, then it makes it easier to go through it. Part of the process then of getting through it is aligning yourself, your thinking, your mind, your heart with the fact that God is faithful. Right? How do you do that? You get on your knees. You devote yourself to prayer. You go back time and time again in the midst of your struggle and your trial, and you go back and get on your knees and say, you're God, I'm not, and whatever you're going to take me through is what I'm going to go through. And apparently these things are inevitable. You're going to go through them anyway. Anybody here endured anything you really didn't want to go through? Everybody. Did you go through it anyway? Yeah, of course you did. Yes. So if it's inevitable, if you're going to go through it anyway, then it's good to find the comfort in the midst of it that the God who brought that your way cares about you, loves you. All things are working together for our good to those who love God, who are the called, in that last phrase, according to His purpose, not according to our purpose. So devoting yourself to prayer is a very practical, very good instruction because we forget to do it. It's very easy for us to wander away from doing it. But if we recognize it as part of the Christian life, part of the obligation of living as a Christian, part of walking out our Christian faith, if you recognize that part of that is devoting yourself, setting aside the time, making sure that you spend time at the throne of God talking to Him, then all those trials and the struggles and the heartache have somewhere where you can deposit them. You can lay them at His feet. He'll help you carry those burdens. And if you know you have access to the God of everything and that He's willing to carry that burden with you, how silly are we not to take it to Him? Walking around like self-made men. I got this one, God. I'll carry this myself, don't worry. You have access to the God of forever. Take your cares, take your concerns to Him. So he says, devote yourselves to prayer. Look at the next phrase. keeping alert in it. When I pray, especially when I pray at the end of the day, I have to put myself in a bodily position where I won't doze off. Am I the only one here?
Uh-oh.
Okay, fine. Okay, we're testifying on that side of the room. I used to try to pray once I laid in bed. I'd say, right? Okay, they're testifying on this side of the room. Yeah, once I hit the pillow and I start praying, next thing I know, in my mind, I'm on a carnival ride somewhere and, you know, my dreams are taking over, and I'll wake up the next day and think, did I reach amen? No, I don't think I did. So I put myself in a bodily position. That's why I've said this phrase several times, on your knees. Doesn't have to be on your knees, but it's a decent place to be because my knees hurt. And so I'm not going to doze off on my knees because it keeps me alert. And so Paul very wisely, I think, knowing what we're like, says, keep alert in it. Devote yourself to it and stay alert in it. Think about what you're doing. For heaven's sakes, you are calling on the name of the eternal God. You're asking for his attention. Sure, God, I know you're busy right now. I don't know, keeping all the planets spinning. You've got that whole universe thing to take care of. The ever-expanding universe is all under your control. And there are millions of people at this very moment crying out to you in trouble and pain and need and everything. But I'd like you to pay attention to me for a moment. And I would like to talk to you, God, about my personal... Hang on. I'm sorry, did you like the impression of the dozing off? God knows whether you're genuine and sincere about your prayers, the same way he knows if you're genuine and sincere about your Christian life, your Christian walk, your attitude toward other people. If you're going to call on the name of God, of all the things you do in life, wouldn't that be the place where you would want to be alert? Wake up, pay attention. I've been teaching my daughter to drive. And one of the rules that I've taught her, right, honey? One of the rules that I've taught her over and over and over again is when you're driving, what are you doing?
Driving.
See, that's so obvious. When you're driving, you're driving. Never forget that. Because we've all seen people rolling down the highway that are driving while they're putting on makeup. Okay, that was only one half of the human population I just identified. Or while they're driving, they're reading. Have you seen those folks with the newspaper on their steering wheel? What are you thinking? Or the people who roll by and the music is so loud, there's no way they can think about anything except how deaf they're going. You're driving, for heaven's sake. You're in a car, you're in a large piece of metal, barreling down a highway at 70. You're driving! Well, I would say the same thing about prayer. I think that's what Paul is getting at here. You're praying. You're talking to the God of ages. Be alert. Devote yourself. Pay attention. What are you doing now? You're praying. You have to devote yourself to that. That is not the time to balance your checkbook in your head. That is not the time to sit and think about your struggles at work or the argument you had with a coworker. This is the time to talk to God. This is the time to ask the God of ages for his attention and then tell him everything that's on your heart. And the last thing Paul says is, and do it with thanksgiving. One of the hallmarks of the generation we live in is that we're just plain, flat, spoiled. If you live in the lower part of the middle class of America, even if you live in the upper part of the lower class of America, if you live in America, you're still living above the other three-quarters of the world that don't have access to the quality of food, quality of water, quality of medicine, quality of public service. And we take these things so for granted. We have so many things, I'm not going to go into this because you've all heard me say it way too many times. But we live in a time, in a generation, in a place, in a nation where you can be rolling down the street in your car that cost you thousands of dollars, and you're sitting in your air-conditioned, well-carpeted car rolling down the road, and the thought can run through your head, I think I'm hungry. And you don't even have to get out of your car to drive through a place and 5 minutes later, you're cramming a double cheeseburger Whopper into your face. Right? That's how spoiled we are. When was the last time you said thank you? See, God is under no obligation to give you any of that. In fact, there are people on this planet, the planet that God made, the planet that God rules, there are people on this planet that don't have all that. Same God, same control, same choices and decisions, and he decided that you were going to have enough to eat, clothes to wear, products for your hair, that we could have glasses to correct our vision, things to stick in our ears if we can't hear well. Endless amounts of devices that make our life easier, more comfortable. And we take it all so for granted. God was under no obligation to give you anything. Do you know what God is obligated to give you based on the Bible? Do you know what he's obligated to give you? If you belong to him, he has obligated himself to two things on a daily basis. Do you know what they are? Food and raiment. Something to eat today. Something to wear today. That's all Jesus ever talked about. It's all the Bible ever says. Food and raiment. If you had something to wear today and you ate something today, God was faithful. And yet if God doesn't give us every desire of our heart, we'll question his faithfulness and his love for us. God, I'm less comfortable today than I was yesterday. I have an argument with you. No, food and raiment. Do you have something to wear? By the way, if you have the same set of clothes to wear every day for 3 years, God is faithful. You understand me? See, we would complain if we don't have a change of clothes. But think about the first century church. Think about how they dressed, what they wore. Most of them had a robe. Most of them had a raiment, an overcoat. They'd use the overcoat at night to keep them warm. They'd use the overcoat during the day to keep the sun off them. When Jesus died, how many changes of clothing did he have?
One.
He had one robe, and then they cast lots over that. Okay, so let's pick somebody at random. Kristen. I'm guessing you own a closet.
Yeah.
See the outfit you're wearing right now? Me personally, I've seen you a lot of times. I've never seen that outfit before. Is it new?
Kinda.
Yeah, see, this is only kinda new, and you've never worn it to church before. That's how many clothes you have, right? Like, if we went home and we opened your closet, would we find, like, a lot of clothes?
Yeah,
I kinda think so, huh? Yeah. When was the last time you told God thank you for a whole lot of clothes? When was the last time you stood in the middle of your closet and went, I am spoiled out of my little girl head? Because you are. But we, because we're humans, can get used to our level of spoiled so that we think anything less than our level of spoiled is somehow a detriment. Somehow God's not playing fair with me. I have less than my fair share of spoiledness happening today. Here, we'll pick on somebody else. Okay, you three boys. Has your mom ever put food in front of you that you said to her, I don't like this? No? Oh, yeah. That's real funny. Because he went, yeah. He went, no. I've always said that my son James would make a bad food critic because everything he eats, he likes. So that's how you are, huh? You're like, I like everything mom gives me. You're like, not so much. If you have food in front of you, think how spoiled you are. There are people on the planet today that not only have no food, they can't go to where the food is and no one's bringing any food to them. There are people on the planet today starving to death, and we get picky about what food we eat. I don't like that food. I like this food. I'll have more of this food, thank you. We're so spoiled. Say thank you. Food and raiment. God is so faithful. Jesus said, speaking of your life, take no thought for tomorrow. The things of tomorrow will care for themselves, and sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof. You have enough trouble today. You just worry about today. The great thing is you have the promise from God that today is taken care of. You're going to have food and raiment today. But that's all he's ever promised you is today. So, everybody in the room doing okay today?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm fine today. We're all here because we're okay. We got clothes, we had something to eat, God's been faithful. You all drove here in cars. If it's a little too cold in your home, you turn your heat on, you don't even have to make a fire. If it's a little too warm in your home, you just hit the air conditioning. Because we're very, very comfortable today. Well, that is proof then that God is faithful. Today he has provided everything necessary and much more. On a planet where there are people too hot, too cold, starving, nothing to wear, and you have so much. So Paul says, don't just say thanks, but stay alert when you say thanks. Devote yourself to saying thank you. Devote yourself to prayer, go back to your Father, and yes, he wants to hear from you. Yes, he wants to hear about your questions, your struggles, your trials, your requests. Absolutely, Paul says that we're to go ahead and bring our issues before God, but always, 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 whenever prayer is talked about in the Bible, there is always the addition with thankfulness, with thanksgiving. We don't go make our requests known to God with the expectation that he is obligated to do whatever we ask. Instead, we bring our petitions before God with thankfulness, recognizing that the sovereign is going to do what is right. And then we align our thinking with his rightness. You got that? I love how down-to-earth the Bible is. Sometimes people can spiritualize it to the point where it kind of loses its meaning. But when I read words like, devote yourself and keep alert, I really believe that 2,000 years ago, Paul was writing that for me. Because I forget to devote myself, and I don't always stay alert when I'm praying. I need the admonition, devote yourself and stay alert. And if you're anything like me, and really God help you if you are. But if you're anything like me, you need that admonition too. Verse 3, praying at the same time for us as well, that God may open up to us a door for the word so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I also am imprisoned. What a great contrast. Paul's in prison and saying, pray for us, that even in this imprisonment, I have an opportunity to tell someone else. I want to keep preaching the mystery of Christ, and I just want one more opportunity. Keep praying that God will open up another door and that I'll still have the opportunity to tell somebody else about Christ. So then he says, in order that I may make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. So Paul's saying, pray that in the preaching of the gospel, pray to God that number one, I'll have an opportunity, and number two, I'll speak clearly. Notice Paul did not say, you know, I've been at this for some time now, and I have a method, and I'm pretty good at it. You know, I take people down the Roman road and then try to get them to make a profession. They say the sinner's prayer, and I'm getting people saved by the thousands because I have a method. I have a technique. I have a way to do this. None of it. He said the opportunity to preach the gospel to somebody is God-given. Pray to God that he'll give me an open door, says Paul, to preach the gospel more to somebody else. Do you recognize then that here in our lives, in the life of GCA, in your life as individual Christians, every time that you have an opportunity to talk to somebody, every time you have an opportunity to tell them something about Christ, it's because the King is doing his job. It's because God has opened up yet another opportunity. Don't take that stuff for granted. Lives are hanging in the balance. God is in the process of saving his people. The God of forever is glorifying himself in the salvation of particular people, and he decided to let you in on it. Do you realize what an honor that is? He says, I think I'll use Jeff. I picked on Jeff earlier. But I'll tell you this. There's nobody better in my experience in a one-on-one conversation about the things of God than Jeff. There are people sitting in this room right now because Jeff talked to him. Jeff is so aware. Jeff is so respectful of the power of the word, the power of the gospel, and whose the sheep are. And I've never once seen Jeff get uppity or braggadocious about it. He'll write back to me sometimes, send me emails, or call me up and say, I can't believe what just happened. It was like right in the middle of my work day, God opened up this guy's mind and his heart, and he came over to my desk, and all he wanted to talk about was the gospel. And I took him to the Bible, and I showed him some verses, and he'll call me, and he's all excited about it because he's never lost the thrill of knowing that God is at work in people's lives. And I find that really encouraging because I stand up here twice a week and try to tell the truth and try to preach, and I do my preparation and I do the work and I'll do my study, and then I come here and I deliver the information to you all, and I just hope and pray that God uses it. And then every once in a while I'll get an email from somebody out there on the internet, or somebody in the room will come up, or some stranger will walk through the door that we've never seen before, and then a month later he's still here. And we go, oh, something good is happening. God is at work here. I hope that I never lose the thrill, the real thrill of watching God change people. How many of you were here when Renee was baptized? How many of you attended Renee's baptism? Yeah, a good handful of us. If you haven't, go back on the internet and watch it again. Listen to what Renee says. And then try not to cry. I dare you. In that moment, she perfectly encapsulated the thrill of the recognition that the King of the universe decided to open her mind and her heart. Like Lydia of old, suddenly she was alive. And she said, for the first time, the Bible makes sense. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And she wept, and we all wept. And I didn't even care, because I was already getting wet anyway. So, you know, the tears were just, you know. Yeah, it's just a great thing when God decides to pick some sinner, some wretch, some truly needy, decrepit human, and say, you're mine, and you're so mine that before I made anything, I wrote your name down. That's how sure I was that you'd be born and that you'd live, and that in the course of your lifetime, I would interrupt your life and introduce myself and draw you to myself and guarantee you an eternity in my presence so that I could say to you that I had always, always loved you, and I have a book where I can prove it. Won't it be fun? I'm at a lack for adjectives here. Won't it be fun to see your name in that book? Yeah, exactly. I will. I'll be doing this. I'll be going right. McClarty, James T. McClarty. I'm in the book. Won't that be great fun? Won't it be great to know that the God of forever, when you finally see him, when you're finally in his presence, and he's just absolutely overwhelming, and you can't begin to do anything but just get on your face, and he'll come to you and say, I'm going to dry away all your tears. There's no more pain. There's no more death. And oh, yeah, let me show you something. Look, it's your name. I wrote you down. You say, yeah, my life was hard, though. My life was tough. He'll say, yeah, but you're in the book. You go, yeah, you're right. Man, I struggled. It wasn't always easy. I went through, oh man, I did some sinning. Oh my goodness. Now that I'm in the presence of the holy, righteous God, I did some bad. And he's going to say, yeah, but your name is in the book. And you go, oh yeah, that's right. Paul says, pray that Christ will open doors so that I'll have an opportunity to preach the gospel, and then pray that I'll have clarity in my speech so that I can tell the truth and that I can tell it right, that I can tell it clear, that I can tell it precisely. There's two sides to that equation. I want to point them both out. Paul said, pray, number one, that God will open doors for me to preach. That means God has to prepare the people who hear the preaching. Then he said, and pray that I'll teach it and preach it clearly. So it has to be God that enables the message to go out. So if the message goes out with clarity, that's God. If people hear it and respond to it, that's God. So which part do we get to brag about?
None of it.
It's all God. I keep saying God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself in the salvation of his people. If the word of God gets preached, that's God. If the people hear the preachment, that's God. Because it is all the enterprise of God. He puts his word out and he opens hearts to hear that word. And that way he gets all the glory for the preaching and the hearing. It all redounds to him. Conduct yourselves, verse 5, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward others, toward the outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. In other words, he's saying for those outside the church, for those who don't know Christ, he says make sure that when you talk to them that you conduct yourself with an appropriate wisdom. Use wisdom in speaking to them, making the most of the opportunity, because you don't know if maybe God's going to open their heart. And maybe give you an opportunity to speak clearly to them. And then he says, let your speech always be with grace. Always with that kindness, not beating people up. Has anyone here ever been accosted by a classic Bible thumper waiting outside a store to beat you on the head with a Bible? Anybody here? Yeah. Doesn't that turn you off? I often wonder if anybody's ever been converted by that technique. I remember walking out of a movie theater one time and a guy coming running up saying, have you made your peace with Jesus today? And I kind of stopped and looked and said, listen, that's not a biblical approach to anything. Running up to strangers, yelling at them. And he said, well, you don't want to burn in hell, do you? You don't want to burn in hell. And I went, okay, show me that in the Bible. You have one in your hand. Show me where that's the approach anywhere. Men will relate to this. Hey, when you were in high school, guys, did you ever have a girlfriend, not even a girlfriend, a girl who was like so hooked on you that she would threaten you to try to get your love? You know what I'm talking about? Anybody? Am I the only one that dated psychos? Pam, you gotta love me. If you don't love me, I'm gonna kill myself. If you don't love me, I'm going to sit in front of your house in my car all night long till you feel such sympathy that you'll come out and you'll talk to me. Talk to me, you have to love me. Sound familiar to anybody? Does that work? No. Okay, now take that into a Christian religious frame. What do you look like as a Christian when you run up to somebody going, you have to believe. You have to believe you're going to go to hell. You're going to go to hell if you don't believe. You're going to... Does that work? No, it makes them make that noise. See, it doesn't... That doesn't work. You can't dangle people over hell and scream believe at them. That doesn't work. Do you know what converts people? The grace of God. The grace of God in the preachment and the grace of God that causes their heart to be open to hear it. And so Paul is very clear in saying, when you're dealing with outsiders, make the most of the opportunity and let your speech always be with grace. Grace is the message. Grace needs to be the attitude. Grace is the approach. It's grace, 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 grace. How many of us grew up in church and were never really converted to genuine Christianity till we heard the message of grace? Yeah, that's everybody here. And when you heard it, didn't you go, I'm so tired of being pounded on by religion. I'm so tired of rules and regulations. And then somebody came and said grace to me. And I just let my shoulders down and went, that's what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for somebody to tell me, God's not mad at you. And it's not because of what you did. It's because of how gracious he is. It's because of what he already did. I spent so much time listening to people tell me, do the work, and then God will take you to heaven. Do the work. And then I heard the message of grace that said, the work is done, you're going to heaven. I love that. So if I love it that much, and if it did so much for me, and if it converted me with such a passion, wouldn't that be exactly what I'd want to take to other people? Listen, the only reason I'm standing here right now, look, I'm going to let you go. Okay, so we didn't get out of Colossians. Okay, we will next week.
Promises.
Oh, you cynics. The only reason I'm standing here right now doing what I'm doing, the only reason that I stand here twice a week and put in the work and put in the effort and don't do so many other things I'd rather be doing. I'd rather be running around having a social life, but I have to devote myself to the time that it takes to be ready to stand up here twice a week and do this. And then all of the other peripheral stuff that goes with it, the internet and the email and the phone calls and all the stuff that goes with it. I do it for one central reason. Because the message of grace changed me so dramatically. The message of grace made my whole life make sense. The message of grace opened the Bible in a way that nothing else ever did. And the God of grace is the only God I want to tell people about. I understand Paul saying, pray that I have an opportunity. Pray that God opens a door so I can tell somebody else. I understand that because all I want out of my life, as long as there's breath left in me, is to tell one more person the message of grace, because it changed me so dramatically that I hope and pray it'll change you too. And if you ever get it, if you ever understand it, if it ever takes root in you, then we will become friends and brethren. And we will love each other in a way that just passes human understanding. And we will be the community of the saved, the redeemed, the elect, the blood-bought, the ones who are written down in the book. And then we're going to forgive each other, and we're going to be kind to each other, and we're going to help each other and lift each other up, because we're all living by the same principle, which is grace, 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 grace. So remember to pray. Pray diligently. Pay attention. Devote yourself to it. And then when you're dealing with people, pray that God gives you an opportunity to speak the mysteries of Christ and make sure that whoever you talk to, that your message is grace. He's going to say in a moment, and seasoned with salt. Salt was a preservative. He's going to say, make sure that the things you talk have that preserving quality, that preserving nature, and only the message of grace has that. Everything else is just pounding on people's head with legalism that can't help them. But the message of grace, boy, that changes hearts and minds and lives. So that's what we preach here. Grace, 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 grace. You got it? You got it?
Yes.
Oh, it's about time.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.